in a developmental culture, all people work to produce this thing we're calling higher value. So an example of that is something that simultaneously changes the customer's life while making the community they're in and Earth resources we use and all the co-creators who are involved feel like they have meaningful work and something that works as a system. At this level, they're tending to people and events with what you might call equanimity and acceptance. It's not a rush or hard to do. It's just thought about all the time. And they're seeking to uplift Earth, uplift life on it. And that is infused into the culture, not as a separate mission where you have an authoritative way to work, but you have a mission on the side. A developmental culture has those fused together where the global imperatives are embedded in work.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. But first, we want to welcome this month's sponsor, Seed Communities, which uses a regenerative paradigm to develop human beings and businesses by bringing an approach designed from the ground up on how living systems work and change. Most education and change management is based on transference of metaphors of how machines operate or rats function in cages. This approach leaves most of the unrealized potential of systems on the table, shortchanging people and life itself. And as a member of Seed Communities, I can tell you the difference is profound for the development of myself as a leader and how I grow my own business. When I found Seed Communities, it was like I finally found a way to think about things without all the drawbacks. We hope you're going to check out this great regenerative education philosophy at seedcommunities.com. And that's spelled seed-communities.com. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. And by the way, if you want to learn more about how to work more closely with us, stay tuned at the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big, hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach. You know, I got a great suggestion for a second opinion last week from a handful of members of that regenerative business development community you were talking about. We were working on culture. We have a leadership phase where we do a lot of looking at, well, leadership is really about leading where the business is going, but also leading where an industry is going and where a culture is. And how and what you have to know if you really want to change it.
So I'm pretty excited about this one, Carol. So I focused on culture a lot when I was in the health system up in BC, and it was also starting to come up more and more in my current company. So for our listeners, I know we've discussed culture on Business Second Opinion before, but one of the principles that Carol and I work from is all about never doing the same thing on the same subject twice. So it's important for us to tackle a mysterious subject like culture and do it differently each time, getting it deeper and deeper into the idea.
Right. Same thing this time, but as you say, moving forward into a new way of looking at it. People were so excited about this subject because, of course, even in the community we're working in, it wasn't the same thing. And they were ready to go off to work with what they'd learned. And knowing that it's not a program fix, even though they'd just gone through a workshop, they reflected at the end and wanted more. And one member said, "Why don't you and Zach do a podcast on this subject?"
I like that a lot, actually. But we need some particular things to do that, right? Like, where's the first opinion? Because we don't give an opinion on a subject, but a critique of someone else's opinion on a subject. But let's pause for a second here, Carol. Can you remind folks why we approach things that way?
Right. So obviously the title of the show gives you some idea. But I reminded them that we are always working off a first opinion on some business subject, but it's publicly available because we're working on building thinking skills. And we want people to be able to do their own assessment alongside of us.
Right. Exactly. So too often people send a subject and they say they want just our opinion flat out, but we do not do that.
Right. We're critiquing, adding to, augmenting a written, sometimes an oral argument, but mostly a written one that someone has made on a subject, usually how to do something in a business or an organization. And as you pointed out, people often send along their own opinion. and then ask us for the other side of the story, basically affirm theirs, and ask us to present that on the show. The only thing then that we can comment on, because we give a second opinion, is their opinion, and no one else can see it. So you need a written opinion publicly available on a business subject. We don't comment on things like mining and airports and things that are not about generally how the business works. It needs to be interesting, and hopefully it's discussed already in print, which makes it easy for you to find something. Then we have a subject, which we get requests on, but we have the author's opinion in writing. We have our own opinion, and then these can be used to create an interesting thinking puzzle.
Right. And then we comment on the written public opinion of that subject, and people can compare their own thoughts, which is the whole point.
Right. So the members who recommended culture change got it when I told them all this. They searched, they found, and they sent me an article. It's about 10 years old, but I didn't even realize that as I was reading it because it sounded like what people still say today. So Zach, you read it. What would you say that they're advocating about how it should change culture in the article? Then people will know what we're giving a second opinion on.
Yes. Okay. Great. So the article, so publicly available, anyone wants to go find this. So the article was from Harvard Business Review, and it's called Let's Talk Culture Change by Ron Ashkenaz from March 22nd, 2011. So the article is basically structured like a case study more than anything else. So I had to extract what I thought Ron was trying to demonstrate here. But what it seemed to me was that he was saying was that culture change is daunting, right? Which is fair. It's daunting because culture change, though, is a soft concept and therefore not measurable, which makes it hard to change, was one of his theses. The other is that, secondly, culture represents the collective norms and behaviors of a group of people. And so, as Ron says in the article, it's hard enough to change one person's behavior. How do you change an entire organization then? So Ron goes on to tell a story about a manager in a large consumer products company coming into a new manager role at a notoriously difficult to manage facility. So the manager vows to change the culture and does so through three following kind of processes or ideas. So first, he comes in straight away and starts communicating with his frontline staff, which the previous manager had not done. Second, he works with his leadership team to develop a vision and value statement for the company. And then third, in order to kind of use this vision and value statement and make it more concrete, he instructs his managers to model the behaviors that they came up with, which are kind of instantiated in the values and vision statement. And they do that all the while using kind of normal everyday communications channels to teach and reinforce the new behaviors in order to convert people to the point of critical mass where then they felt everyone would be able to change.
Well, I could hear it even in your voice, but I have a curiosity about what was your opinion of the points that you've just described?
Yeah, I wear my heart on my sleeve a little bit. Okay, so I think that this article is getting stuck a little bit in the same trap that a lot of other ideas about culture change do. So it's basically, let's reduce the idea of culture to be about behavior change at scale. And the only way to change behavior is through, you guessed it, behaviorism. That means role modeling combined with positive and negative reinforcement and rewards in order to ultimately get people trained to behave like you as a manager want.
All right, so we point this out, you and I, over and over again, that this shows up in Harvard Business Review. Why do these ideas matter that you're speaking about here? And where do you see them leading people if you were to follow this new manager's advice?
Right, yeah, okay. So let me ground this a little bit. So the good news is I've seen this kind of strategy at work in healthcare. The bad news is it's ineffective at actually growing people. So this kind of a practice is very well-meaning, but ultimately it leads to other toxic issues in the workplace, like burnout, depression, resentment, ultimately leading to high turnover, right? And then the list goes on from there. So Gallup actually conducted a global workplace poll in 2017, 7 years after this article was written, during which they discovered that 15% of people were actively engaged at work. So meaning 85% of people were disengaged at work. And this was like a billion people that they did a survey of. So a surface change in behavior is one thing, but people actually actively deriving meaning from and using work as a way of contributing to the lives of others seems to be incredibly far away from what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And the thing I think that leads to what you're talking about with depression, burnout, resentment, and this only 85% of, only 15% of people really love coming to work is it's all externally determined. People are trying to determine me by what they want me to do. And then the members in the session that gave me this idea were really asking deeper questions because they knew that they didn't want to be following a behavioral approach. We'd already talked about that. But I gave them something we might use here today to switch it out of that. We talked about that there are three paradigms of a way it is you can create culture. The first one we might call authority-centered, which you and I were just talking about. The empathetic-centered cultural paradigm, and the developmental-centered one.
Right. Okay. So let's start with the first one first. So the authority at the center is the old command and control paradigm, for sure, where it's all top-down, centralized, and dictator-like in management process.
Yes, I would agree with that. But I think it does include more than that. I think there are benevolent versions of this. They may be a little less dogmatic, but you know, you heard the term the benevolent dictator, right? I believe that can be authority driven because the authority paradigm can be the one that gives clear direction. It's authoritative. It works to prove trust. And it's often expert-based. People are in roles. People are brought in from outside. People are promoted because of their expertise. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, totally. Totally, right? So let me give you an example. So if you do even cursory research on the impact investing space, for example, this is a space that's all about doing better than typical investors, you know, in their kind of investors in return first sort of financial paradigm while attempting to be less dogmatic. Meanwhile, many of the companies often share the same management structure and practices as their old paradigm counterparts. It's really the same way of working with a fresh coat of paint.
Right. So they have changed the subject matter, but as you're saying, the managing process is just like the place they left. So I think this one, I mean, if I had to say, what are they about? And not be too judgmental about it, because I want people to be able to see both sides of how people are going about this, is they're really focused on functional performance, get the job done, and the ability to what they might say is adhere to patterns. We have certain expected behaviors here, certain mental models we work with thinking. So this can happen in a malicious way or a benevolent way.
Yeah, totally. So let me give you another example. So one relatively straightforward way to recognize all this at work is through titles representing a level of authority in the workplace. So these roles also matter in our lives beyond work in this paradigm. So the big decisions, as you'll see in the world, are often made by powerful, you know, smarter and the most talented people. Well, so-called anyways. So for example, when I was 22 in finance, my title was vice president, right? A 22-year-old being called vice president, yeah. Right? So that title was given to all of us on the sales side because it was intended to seem to our clients on the outside that we had more meaningful positions than sales associate, because people associate vice presidents with having authority and smarts and power and brilliance and all these other kind of things. So he must know something about what I'm trying to talk about. Yeah. So in the world where titles matter, they indicate authority.
Oh, they're very good indicators. I'm sorry, I was trying not to laugh, but yeah, I mean, they're such good examples of being externally determined or externally influencing, like trying to trick customers. And all of it is trying to give you the sense of authority Where did you see that here in this article?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Good call. Okay. So in the article, everything flowed from Ted, who was at the top of the factory. He's the manager that Ron was describing in the case study. So then it flowed all down to his leadership team from Ted. So that was ideas, authority, everything, right? Flowed from Ted to his leadership team, and then from there to his managers, and then down to his frontline workers. So all the ideas and behaviors came from him and his leadership team as the sole authority. They then externally determined how everyone else should behave, like in the examples Ron gave of making their staff swear less and take shorter breaks.
Well, and as you said, there was the whole idea of role modeling, where people were being shown the pattern with the clear indication that they were supposed to copy it and, of course, be reinforced. So all change, all decisions, all were communicated, and this is always a clue, in a cascading form from top to bottom. This, and you know, the term always is get it out to the ranks, right? Ranking and rating. So I can see that in here.
Yeah, definitely. This is exactly the same structure as healthcare, and it's even more siloed actually in healthcare. So in a given hospital, you'll have two verticals of hierarchy. You'll have the administrative managerial team with an executive director at the top, and then a medical hierarchy with the doctors at the top, with all the nurses at the bottom of everything. So it's no wonder nurse turnover rates range between like 8 and 37% nationally. And that's also not including internal churn. So how would you feel if you had two sets of bosses constantly trying to change your behavior? It's like mom coming in telling you to clean your room one way, and then 10 minutes later, dad coming in and saying something totally different.
All right. So we now have a pretty clear picture of the authoritative structure. We could call it authoritarian if it gets over on one end. The second culture that I mentioned earlier was the empathetic culture paradigm. Now, these are the people who say, I don't want that command and control anymore. I want more what we might call sensitive energy in the organization. And behavior becomes important, but there's a new kind of behavior people are paying attention to. There's an expectation that people, their origins, their gender, will all be acknowledged and paid attention to. There's expected to be a level of awareness and caring in such organization that doesn't exist in the authoritative one we just talked about. We want everybody on automatic. Here, being is expressed more openly in the business, you know, who I am, what I'm feeling about things, than it is in the automatic cultures.
And another point here that I'll just add on to is that leadership seeks participation, input, and ideas from across the organization. They may also support training and task forces for resolving issues that affects all groups of people. So I'm sure this is familiar to a lot of our listeners.
Right. And because of that, I mean, that's an example of that they actually do have an expectation and encourage people to look for upgrades, to look for improvements, even in how the work systems work. They're asked for ideas. And each decision is made against something else that is clear. They're, you know, often in the authoritative, you don't know where that decision came from. In this one, there is an ongoing attention to make sure the goals, the purposes, why you're being asked to do it, come along with the decision. So generally speaking, the members of the organization are carefully schooled in guidelines of how we expect members of the organization and how they can work to be more sensitive.
And this is a big shift, right? Like people in an organization operating in an empathetic paradigm in terms of a level are expected to direct their work toward kind of three things, generally speaking. So first, really addressing their will to be of service is the first thing.
Yeah.
The second thing, in terms of like a being level, they're expected to exhibit and bring their full selves and qualities appropriate to the activity that they're involved in and avoid being mechanical or generic in how they're doing that. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is that they orient their behavior towards maintaining desired standards of performance rather than just adhering to job descriptions.
Yeah, so a way of summarizing those three is a little like people are expected to be involved in their work. Don't just come to work for a paycheck. And they see it as their job to evolve and grow themselves as workers. They become accountable to manage situations with the intention of being fair, being equitable, bringing diversity into the consideration. And they're seeking, therefore, to include more people and give more opportunity on a broader spectrum. This, I think, is based on the idea that people are able to grow and evolve, which isn't necessarily true of the authoritative, but they're believed to be able to do that here if they put in the work.
Right. And for those who do the hard work, they develop a higher level of presence beyond their title. It can also lead to promotions as well as involvement in projects or engagement in special tasks. Gaining experience is really the hallmark rather than past performance as the indicator of what was possible for a person in the automatic paradigm.
Yeah, we do know that at this point, something like core competencies are put in place in this kind of culture. And the reason for that, as you said earlier, is it's all soft and squishy, right? How do you describe what you want the culture to be? Well, and because these are mostly, and this article is all about behaviorally driven, you get core competencies. So here you believe it will be fair, right? Everyone will know what's expected. Everyone will know what to aspire to, and that they know where to target their personal growth if they were willing to step up to the hard work. And then collaboration and teamwork can be brought to a much higher degree of accessibility for everyone. And the intention is to reduce competitive processes among the people in the business. Zach, what's your experience of this paradigm? How is it to you different than the authoritative one we just talked about?
Well, it's interesting because we definitely had this one too in healthcare, right? Because it almost showed up as like a response to authority. So there was this acknowledgement that the results of what was happening for frontline workers like nurses was not going well, right, as evidenced by the high turnover and burnout. So instead, the health authority would bring in consultants to do evaluations using competencies to evaluate people and use coaching and facilitation-based processes to try to make them or help them find meaning at work. And this would put people on rails to become what was perceived as better managers and give them a path towards higher levels of responsibility. But in a lot of cases, this would backfire because, once again, it was all about rewards and recognition rather than actual development. So I remember in one case that's kind of sad, that it's actually quite sad, was that one of the directors I was familiar with was put forward for a new role in a totally different department for which he was familiar. And so he had all the training and been given all the feedback and found all the meaning and thus was being seen as ready to take on anything. And so within 3 months, he was floundering. And so his vice president, seeing this as a failure of the director, rather than being something about the health authority's process, ended his 30-year career. And it was pretty heartbreaking.
Oh, I hate stories like that. I saw a similar kind of thing happen with another indicator of this empathetic cultural paradigm, which was climate surveys. They said, well, we got to know what's going on with people, so let's ask them. And they put out a whole, 3-month process of interviewing, following up, had a task team, and then brought it to the leader. And this was in a new department. This was his idea. Let's find out where people are. He presented it to his managers, but wanted to include some others, brought them in. And as he presented what the task force, who actually were outside consultants, brought, people listened and they thought, I don't even recognize these. The problem with things like culture surveys, which arise out of this empathetic desire, is they go through 2 or 3 levels of translation. I mean, you come through the outside, the consultants, into the internal managers, into the people who are going to work with them. And the inability to understand how you develop people was lost. And the same thing happened with this guy. He was not let go, but he was written up and he was replaced, all because he didn't know how to carry out a survey.
Right.
All right. So we've looked at the authoritative / sometimes authoritarian. We've looked at the empathetic, which often, as you said, is a reaction to the authoritative. What we do with all the places we're involved is we work with building and helping people understand what a developmental cultural paradigm looks like. And here, what we have are people who become mindful about the value and capability of each person and their or its specific way of being in the world, and be able to enable them by infrastructure and other things to identify on their own what is consistent with their essence. And we're not going to go into essence again today, but each person, each living entity has one and is seeking to express it. So in this paradigm, the people who we believe and work with them being able to aspire to and reach what might be called higher orders of existence, you know, making greater contributions. So generally speaking, they seek to provide products and perform functions that reflect this aspiration to something more meaningful. They really work to have the will to care and to provide a world of social and ecological harmony. And that's valued and brought in as part of what they're seeking to do. And of course, they see living when they leave work and in work as a way of providing what I call, it's a little strange, but redeeming values for the future.
Yeah, and they seem to care about the intrinsic nature of humans in the organization and the striving for higher orders of ableness with a greater understanding of the working of reality. So to follow on to that, they actually make sense of the world from systemic questioning. And in that way, the people don't relate without hierarchies of power, only hierarchies of effectiveness for all living people. And so work is structured so everyone does things out of consciousness and conscientiousness.
Yeah, now all this sounds fluffy, I know, as we say it, but you and I both know that it happens. It takes work. In a developmental culture, all people work to produce this thing we're calling higher value. So an example of that is something that simultaneously changes the customer's life while making the community they're in and Earth resources we use and all the co-creators who are involved feel like they have meaningful work and something that works as a system. At this level, they're tending to people and events with what you might call equanimity and acceptance. It's not a rush or hard to do. It's just thought about all the time. And they're seeking to uplift Earth, uplift life on it. And that is infused into the culture, not as a separate mission where you have an authoritative way to work, but you have a mission on the side. A developmental culture has those fused together where the global imperatives are embedded in work. And everyone's accountable to intrinsically bring this forward and help themselves and others feel life-giving about it. But it also has to be sourced through time. And reflection has to be involved in a whole set of working on inner will. I mean, it's not something you just do overnight. Zach, what's your experience of how essence plays a role, I guess you might say, in this developmental cultural paradigm?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, everything starts from essence thinking, right? Like working to see the pattern behind the patterns of how life works. So as an example, at the hospital where I worked, an aspect of the essence of that community was about self-reliance. And so the hospital was founded in the spirit of the community coming together to create their own hospital when other communities saw them as lesser than or like they didn't need it or deserve it. So we worked to infuse all this into projects and initiatives that were being called for in the community. And it was interesting because as a result, our hospital ended up being a pilot community for many successful projects that actually ended up being emulated throughout the rest of the health authority.
Right. You know, I'm thinking about how important it is in the developmental paradigm to be able to have in place something that you know you're going to be able to step up to that kind of work. So I create, anybody who works with me for a while, gets everyone involved after 3 or 4 years of building capability to make promises to particular customers or markets or industry levels. And there's an infrastructure, so they aren't just coming up with things out of thin air. The infrastructure is part of the culture. It's a way of saying, we aren't doing this just casually for you. We really want you to be able to contribute, bring your own essence into it. I guess I'd say the big shift that happens at this level is work and the ways of working all are about building everyone being accountable from their own inner essence, their own contribution, and knowing whatever effects they have. They are thinking about others and about planet, about communities, about all their other coworkers, and they step up to personal agency to be able to contribute to the overall corporate direction. And that's what makes one of these cultures work. So looking at our story, how did that get handled with these folks in our article?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, our HBR case study lacks a lot of these ideas, right? As if not all of them. As we see, most of the concepts end up living in the lowest order of a paradigm here. As our protagonist, Ted, hopes to externally determine how everyone at the factory behaves. While his metrics of performance and safety incidents have begun to move in what were viewed as more favorable directions, this type of change is often transitory and leaves when Ted and his managers leave. What's worse, in the article, it focuses inside the organization, leaving out almost any mention, well, actually any mention of customers, markets, innovation, any of that. Instead, this is all, I assume, left to Ted and his expert team.
So this has been a fun conversation. If I think about the developmental culture and regenerative leadership, as we talk about it, they work with developing humans. Their ability to design, to build culture, to foster, I mean, as you say, consciousness and conscientiousness. And they work to develop people to be self-directing, as using what I call the infrastructure that is ongoing, always there, always developing and building capability. We'd like to let you know, as we often do here at the end, that we have a set of learning communities, some for individuals, some in education, some in entrepreneurial world, some in teams coming together who are governing boards. And we have communities that we hope will intrigue you. And this particular show was sparked by a member in one of those communities. The leadership there that they were learning about included culture. So if any of that interests you, we would love for you to check out CarolSanfordInstitute.com, as well as seed-communities.com.
So if you're wondering how to get your ideas selected by Business Second Opinion for a show, please go to our Business Second Opinion webpage to find out more information.
Right, and follow the guidelines we gave it early of today's show. But also for fun, we run a series of book clubs. If it interests you, you can join a book club, get a 50% bulk buy through the publisher, and join one of the book clubs, get more materials, get recordings, workbooks, etc. So more there at carolsanford.com.
This has been Business Second Opinion.